This feature of the Science News Radio Network is coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas. Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
And really, really, it's so good to be with you again as we explore the exciting world of the business of emerging science, open innovation, right here in the Science News Radio Network. And we're going to visit the Den of Strangers, get more wisdom from somebody a lot of us never heard of, visit our fountain of useless information we have here on the set in the second half of the program, and of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. Remind those of you listening on radio, you can hear us commercial-free online, webcast anytime at thepromiseoftomorrow.biz. An exciting show today. We've got Russ Nelms. He's the Verification Consulting Director from Enter Graphics, and they're a major sponsor of Metricon Conference produced by Lockheed Martin, going to be at the Arlington Convention Center, and you can learn more about that at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. And then we're going to check in with author and geneticist Adam Rutherford, who wrote A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived. You're going
to
love it.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Science News Radio Network special presentation, Promise of Tomorrow, with Colonel Mason. Those of you listening on radio can also hear us commercial-free online anytime, webcast, at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Okay, now we're going to go to the phones. And as you know, we've been covering the Metricon Conference, sponsored by Lockheed Martin and produced by IEEE. And we have with us one of the major companies that are doing business with Lockheed Martin as a client, Mentor Graphics. And they're going to be at the conference. You'll be able to go and see them and all that they're doing. And we're lucky we have on the phone right at the moment Russ Nelms. He's the Verification Consulting Director for Mentor Graphics. Welcome to the program, Russ.
Thank you, Colonel.
So good to have you. Now, I'm a little in the dark here about, and I get to ask all the stupid questions. You're the Verifications Consulting Business Manager for Mentor, and you're focused on improving functional verification activities for customers who are developing complex ICs.
Integrated circuits.
All right. Well, tell me a little bit about Mentor Graphics. What does the company do?
Sure. So Mentor is probably the leading electronic design automation company, and we offer our customers tools that help them create complex systems. It could be ICs, PCBs, systems. We have cabling solutions, thermal analysis solutions, everything that's required to really bring up a complex electronic system for almost any application.
Okay, and you've been dealing with Lockheed Martin for a number of years, I understand. Is that right?
That's correct. So my group is responsible for functional verification at the IC level. And Lockheed has been a very good customer for many years. We've helped them do what they call independent verification and validation of some of their electronic systems. So it's been a good relationship, a good partnership between both companies for many years.
Yeah, Lockheed is an old line defense contractor. I mean, from the world wars that we've had, especially the second World War, with a lot of really powerful aircraft, and so developing these new systems is really an intricate thing. Can you give me some of the ideas of some of the things that you've been working on?
Sure. So I guess in general, the complexity of these systems today is really putting more emphasis on functional verification. And what functional verification allows our customers to do is to basically test the behavior of a design before they commit to production. And if they get it wrong, it can be very costly to redo the design. Some of today's ASIC fabrication technologies are extremely expensive. If you miss a design feature or you have a bug in your design and it gets integrated into a larger system and you don't find it until that integration has happened, it can be very costly to find and fix that problem. And then also all of our customers, you know, today's landscape is extremely competitive. So anything that we can do to help them get their products to market faster is something that they really want to focus on. And, you know, a lot of our customer base is really characterized by people that are experiencing really rapid advances in the technology that they're using. They have shrinking market windows. These chips are typically going into mission-critical and safety-critical systems, so you have the added risk of these things not performing the way they're supposed to and potentially causing, you know, property damage, damage to the environment, bodily injury, even loss of life in some cases. So it's an extremely important part of the process, and it's growing in complexity as the chip complexity grows. So it's something that we've been focused on and that our customers are dealing with on a regular basis.
Yeah, I can see the dire need for this. Lockheed Martin, of course, being a defense contractor, is developing all these really complex and interesting systems that are vital to American defense, and you want them to work. And so what you're doing is you're taking proof of concept. You're actually verifying that these things will work in production and actually will do what they say they're going to do and do it in a timely manner, so that Lockheed, when they're going after government contracts and trying to fulfill their obligations in a timely manner, know that they're doing it and they're doing it right. That's the message I'm getting. Is that right?
That's correct. And there's really two aspects to it, Colonel. So there's verification and then there's validation. So the verification is aimed at making sure that the design, the way that it's implemented, meets the design specification. So it was built correctly. All the processes that were applied in the development of the chip were done properly. The validation piece is, does it satisfy the needs of all the stakeholders? Does it have all the right features and functions? And our role is really to create test cases that verify that both of those things are done correctly. So we'll create a variety of scenarios. We'll apply those to a simulation model, and then we'll look at the output of that simulation model and make sure that the chip behaves the way we would expect it to. And in many cases, especially for safety-critical designs, there are overarching standards that dictate what level of assurance is required. This could be DO-254 for some of the avionics requirements, or it could be an ISO 26262 for automotive, for example. But these standards lay out the process that's required to develop these chips, and they prescribe the evidence that you need to produce that you've done it properly. So in a nutshell, that's what my group does, is we really help customers bring up the simulation environment so they can prove their designs will work the way that they were intended to work before they commit to building the designs in silicon.
Absolutely fascinating. Well, you're going to have a major display at the Metricon conference. That's October 26th at the Arlington Convention Center. Let our listeners know that if they want to know more about that conference, they can find it at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of the screen is a link to the Metricon conference, and go there and shake hands with Russ Nelms and see the display for Mentor Graphics, and Russ will be there networking with the different Lockheed Martin engineers and people that, of course, attend in mass to that particular conference. So we're really looking forward to seeing you there. Russ, what if I forgot to ask you? What overriding point do you want to drive home?
Well, I guess that, you know, just in summary, I would say that verification is it's hard to do, and the mistakes can be extremely expensive. Customers really need to be very efficient and coordinated in the way that they approach verification, and they have to continually improve everything that they do. And you know, we like to talk about the three components of a successful project are people, process, and tools. Mentor has world-class tools to satisfy, you know, any facet of verification. We have training programs. We have on-site mentoring to help our customers bring their staff, you know, current in all the technology and everything that they can do. But my group is really focused on creating those processes, those best practices that allow them to use the tools and the people the best way possible so they can produce a really good result consistently. So I'd really love to talk to anybody that has any interest in functional verification at the show, and I really appreciate your time this morning.
Well, we appreciate you being with us. I was wondering if maybe you'd put on your thinking cap a little bit, your futuristic cap, and look down the road maybe 5, 10, 15, or 20 years or something. Do you have a view of the future? Do you see where everything is going? Do you have maybe some inside information or some insight to where things are coming for us? What does the future hold? Do you see anything?
Well, I think it's going to be just more and more complexity. If you look at some of the trends in the autonomous automobile market, for example, that's really driving a whole set of functions that we haven't needed in the past, and they're very critical functions. But I think that you're going to see just added complexity, more focus on process and making sure that you can do it correctly. You know, I think that what we have to do is we just have to make sure that our customers have the tools and the processes and are capable of dealing with all those rapid changes in technology, I think, that are ahead of us.
You really drove a point home there. My fiance just bought a brand new automobile, and I compare it to the Starship Enterprise. I mean, it does everything except blows your nose. It's pretty incredible, the complexities that are coming our way very, very rapidly. And you had mentioned autonomous automobiles, now aircraft, and all sorts of different things, even some work on a battery-powered aircraft, which to me is just incredible because of the weight of the batteries and that sort of thing. And I talk to Lockheed about that pretty constantly. Well, Russ, I know during your career, your early career, you were mentored with some words of wisdom, and you are mentoring people that are working with you right now. Do you have sort of a creed for living, sort of a standard by which you like to hold yourself, or do you have some sort of words of wisdom you can pass on to us?
You know, I would point to my team. I've got a really incredible team of engineers that work for me. You know, they've got a lot of experience. It spans a lot of different areas. They all come with different qualities and different expertise that really lends itself to verification. But I guess my theory has always been to hire really smart people and, you know, give them the latitude they need to do what they do best. And that's proven to be very successful over the years. So,
all right. That's really great advice. All right. Russ Nelms, Verification Consulting Director for Mentor Graphics, going to have a very nice display at the MentorCon conference, sponsored by Lockheed Martin and produced by IEEE. October 26th at the Arlington Convention Center. That's right smack between Dallas and Fort Worth in the Metroplex. So if you want to find out more about that, go to our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a link. And then go on down there to the MetroCon conference and meet Russ Nelms. Russ, so nice to have you with us. Thank you so much for taking your time to be with us today.
All right. Thank you, Colonel.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Science News Radio Network special presentation, Promise of Tomorrow, with Colonel Mason. Those of you listening on radio can also hear us commercial-free online anytime, webcast, at promiseoftomorrow.biz. All right, we're going to go to the phones right now, and we're talking overseas, as a matter of fact. In the UK, we have with us Adam Rutherford. He is an acclaimed science writer and geneticist. He is also a broadcaster, oftentimes with the BBC. He studied genetics at University College in London, and his first book, Creation on the Origin of Life and Synthetic Biology, was published in 2013, and his new book that he has just been released is the provocative title of a brief history of everyone who ever lived, the human story retold through our genes. Welcome to the program, Adam.
It's very nice to talk to you.
And where in the UK did we find you?
I'm actually at the BBC at the moment. I'm in a studio. I've just recorded my program I do for the BBC, which is a weekly science show. It's kind of like Science Friday with NPR. And so I'm actually in the studio where I normally record that program. Yeah.
All right, that's sensational. Well, in your book, you reveal what our genes tell us about our complicated, unique, and communal histories. And it's pretty fascinating. I've been reading it. I must admit that I'm only about halfway through because I'm really enjoying the study of it. What I like about the book so much, if I can get this out of the way just a little bit, is accepting you as an authority. I can breeze through and get a lot of real good meat and potatoes. But if I question as to how you arrived at your conclusions, you're very good about going and saying, this is how we did it, this is how we boiled it down. So someone who is really interested in drilling down can do that in the book, and somebody who's interested in a nice, easy, good, entertaining, I must say, incidentally, you're a very entertaining writer. There are times I had to laugh. But that's what has made the book very, very enjoyable for me.
Well, that's very, very kind of you to say so. I mean, I do want to write for the biggest possible audience, but at the same time, as a working scientist, as someone who, this is my field, I'm not writing about other areas of science that I'm interested in. This is, you know, the area that I've been working in and around for, well, nearly 25 years now. Slightly depressing to say that out loud. But so, in a sense, this was kind of like the book that I've always wanted to write. The timing of it is, I think, really important, because I don't think this book could have been written at any other time other than now, because our knowledge of genetics and our use of genetics in as a sort of historical text has only really come to fruition in the last 5 years maximum, and it's changing so quickly at the moment that I had to keep rewriting the book right until the deadline, and my editors were, you know, constantly annoyed with me sending them emails saying, listen, this new paper was published last week and it basically has to go in because the book's just going to be out of date unless it goes in. So, you know, I want to talk to the broad audience. I want to talk about the whole human story. But at the same time, I think part of my love of being a science communicator is actually just trying to talk about how science is really done. So, you know, tell the story. And hope that people are swept along with the narrative.
Yeah, you warned us several times during the book that there's updates coming in the future, and that this is a rapidly changing. So we're quite prepared for that when we read it.
It's our own creation stories, and so, you know, we're contesting against a lot of human baggage, you know, a lot of presumptions that all humans very naturally make. About racial differences, or about human migrations, or about our own creation stories. So, in that sense, you know, it's quite a challenge telling the science of what we now know in the 21st century about our own history, compared to what we assume that we know based on, you know, 10,000 years of telling these stories.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned sex, and I have to say, it is a very sexy book. If somebody wants a sexy book, this is a sexy book. Of course, it's a scientific sexy book, but it is a sexy, sexy book. And I was explaining to my fiance a little bit about the book. And, of course, we touch on the fact that, you know, before we were enlightened, and we're talking, and you often reference the Bible and the ancient writings and things. A kid might ask his dad, gee whiz, you know, why does the sun come up? Why does it get dark? Where did we come from? So stories had to be made up of an Adam and Eve and of all these other things to satisfy the queries coming from the generations that were coming to try to explain things. And so these things live with us until new science comes along and dispels them. You go back 100,000 years to the present. You cover wide-ranging topics such as the Neanderthals and the Vikings and Richard III and redheads and all sorts of evolution, and it's absolutely fascinating.
I think the thing is that if there's one thing that humans really love, it is stories. You know, we are, for 50,000 years since what we sometimes refer to as the Cognitive Revolution, we have evolved as an organism that is social, that is involved in social groups and social structures are incredibly important to us, and everyone knows this. And we tell stories. We tell stories about our own origins, and we tell stories that are effectively, you know, analyses of who we are. Where do we belong? Who is my tribe? Where do I fit into the grand sweep of my family and the grand sweep of history? And so, you know, those sorts of narratives are just inherent to us. They are storytelling is such an important thing to us as a species. Now, what's happened in the last couple of years with genetics is that we've got so good at understanding how genetics works and how characteristics are passed from generation to generation that DNA has effectively become a tool of storytelling. So it has enabled us to reanalyze some of the stories from history, our deep history back through, like you say, you know, 100,000 years and even further, but also to look at early modern history, such as, you know, the Vikings, the tales of the Vikings, and migrations across Europe, but also the trajectory of the first Europeans to set foot in the Americas, who were also Vikings, the saga of Eric, although they didn't stick around. And then, and more recently, although problematically from a political point of view, the migration of the people, the indigenous peoples of the Americas. So those people who came across around about 20,000 years ago across what is now the Bering Strait, but 20,000 years ago was just land. And they formed the population from which all of the indigenous people of the Americas were derived, and basically remains like that until 1492, when Europeans turn up with Columbus in the West Indies. And so, it is our ability to look at the stories that are inside our bodies, that are contained within our genomes in DNA, and to compare them to what we know from history, from archaeology, from paleoanthropology, but also from stories, from our creation myths, which are, you know, the main one for Judeo-Christians is written down in the Bible, and there's different ones from the Norse sagas, which talk about Vikings, and then there's, you know, many indigenous American stories, many of which are much more inherently tied to the land than is sort of normal within Judeo-Christian creation stories. So it is, like you say, you know, it's another way of talking about the stories that are important to us, our own personal narratives and our narratives, how we fit into the grand sweep of history, which is, it's important to people.
Well, what's interesting is you identified four different homos. Not Homo sapiens, but Homo Neanderthal and even hobbits that existed at one particular time. And it kind of fits in with my sister-in-law, who tells me, she says, you know, there are people that lived before we did. And of course, I say, wait a minute, where's your evidence of that? She says, and Atlantis really existed. She says, it is written about with Plato. And I said, no. That's all. There's no evidence of any of that. So I challenge her on evidence all the time. But you really do bring out evidence, and that's something else I want to ask you about. You mentioned, and I want you to clarify this. You mentioned that the Pope has come out and said that evolution is not a theory, that it really does exist. And you took issue with that because you wanted to point out that theory is really very, very important. And we want to cover that with you when we get back from the break at the half hour. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. Who in the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
Yes, of course. It's Joel Stein. Your relationship with any human is frozen at the point when you first met. It's why all the rules in a romantic partnership are set in the first 2 months.